Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Greece, and more Greece. Stocks claw their way back from a down week to end the week positive. Short-term trender is changing here. And Jennifer McCume is with us from Capital Economics. We're going to talk all about some of the inside about Europe. We're going to talk about stocks. We're going to talk about what to expect from the Fed next week. All this and lots more on episode number 268 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, Andrew Horowitz here, and I got to tell you something. I am more than tired, more than sick, more than exhausted from all of this talk on Greece and Europe. It's about time that they get their act together, and hopefully sometime, I hope, in the next week or so, we're going to get some clarity. We're going to see some meetings that are going to be happening over in Europe. Already there has been discussion again about covered bonds and EU bonds and backed bonds and deposit guarantees and more stimulus and growth and it goes on and on, because the fact of the matter is, let's just get to the point here. The fact is that they really have no idea how to solve their problems there. Kind of just winging it as they go. When they're pressed up against an emergency situation, what do? They just find something that hopefully is going to calm and appease markets for a little while, and that's what we're seeing and why it's causing such high anxiety and incredible volatility in the markets. Even so, we saw the VIX drop down to just over 20 last week. And the last 2 days of the week were pretty incredible with all the bad news. There was some discussion that there could be a coordinated global central bank stimulus or liquidity plan that's on tap. And all of a sudden, man, people got all excited about that. The euro started moving higher. The dollar started caving in, realizing that Bernanke is going to be speaking this week and possibly looking to add some more stimulus, Operation Twist, or some kind of talk or rhetoric that's going to actually do something to appease markets that there is some more stimulative measures on the way. Because realize that right now, when we saw the effects of the Spanish, I don't know what we call it, the bailout or maybe the injection that was supposed to happen last week with $125 billion worth of money directly into the banks. And then we say, well, that's not going to work because you can't do that. You have to go through this other system. And it kind of fell apart, realizing that it was an ill-conceived plan. But Greece clearly is going to be in the spotlight for some time. Already we're seeing that early polls, we haven't seen the final as of the time of this taping. The new democracy, the pro-bailout parties are thinking that maybe they have the edge. They've already asked the concession of the Syriza, I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, party that is looking to say to Europe basically, hey, thanks for the money, but we're out of this. And maybe hitting the eject button on the euro in the eurozone. That would be disastrous. We know that. But it kind of reminds me, doesn't this remind you a little bit of the Y2K situation? Remember back in the year 2000 or 1999, everybody was freaking out. I mean, just absolutely nervous, worried that all of a sudden when it comes and the clock hits midnight on the year 2000, that every computer is going to go down, the economy is going to crumble. And man, there was all sorts of problems. And there was a lot of companies that did what they could to head this off, but the news was just full of all sorts of really bad predictions, and everybody and their brother was out there saying, hey, man, this is going to be really bad, and man, nothing happened. I mean, nothing happened. I don't remember anybody talking about a glitch on any single computer around the world that had the situation, and you can't say that, well, everybody fixed it, because there's got to be some outliers out there, but it just never happened. So all this big to-do about the world ending and then nothing. And I don't know if there's a lesson in that. Possibly there is, in that, you know, the media will stir up a lot of anxiety, or that in the end that governments will constantly come to the rescue, or that we're just very nervous about things in general that shouldn't be. But, you know, it's something tells me that I don't want to say this time is different because it's a really bad thing to say, but there's just a lot more that meets the eye with this whole European situation. And frankly, that the powers that be need to come out on a continual basis, not only on a weekly or monthly, but almost daily, trying to protest that, hey, everything is great. Already Monty in Europe and in Italy is saying, hey, we don't need any stimulus. And another country came out and said, hey, we're fine. And Spain's fine. Everybody's fine. But meanwhile, we know that there's a lot of money leaving Europe, and that's finding its way into American markets, U.S. markets. Clearly, in the bond market, we're seeing a lot of bid there. And it was interesting that on Friday, the bonds held up really well, and the stocks were up. You usually see when that happens that the bonds start to sell off a bit because the risk trade is off. But it was kind of a forced buy-in on Friday because you reached over a couple of clear resistance points in the equity markets, particularly the S&P 500. It was options expiration that had a lot to do with it. There was no volume on the markets till about 3:45 on Friday. And that should tell us something, that really a lot of what happened was all based on what was going on in the options market and options expiration. If we would have pulled that out, there would have been like hardly any volume. As a matter of fact, throughout the day, even though markets were a bit higher, even on the bad University of Michigan number, even on the bad New York manufacturing numbers, and even on the negative jobs numbers up at about 386 on the initial claims last week, there's something that is happening that is either structured, that the derivatives are really playing a big role in all this, or there's just an absolute lack of caring, kind of a, you know, we know that things are going to be fixed. We know that nothing's going to happen. We know that governments will step in behind it. It's a very difficult way to invest because price discovery, the ability to find the pricing of a stock that's appropriate, is really hidden because you have so much trading going on in the futures and ETFs markets. And that just generally will swell stocks all at once. And you have this really high correlation amongst stocks that even the stocks that would report poorly or would really not be, quote unquote, deserving of moving higher, moved higher. So that's something we need to pay attention to. So while the indications right now, an hour market trend indicator went to an uptrend on Friday, it was really a question of, wow, that's very interesting that we passed some key price levels. But at the same time, even though the volume was higher on the NASDAQ and on the New York and on the S&P, it really was pushed by options expiration. And if you look historically at options expiration, you'll see that there's usually a move, oftentimes, opposite of the trend that happened the previous number of days after that, because what's happened is that there was a push to move something over a certain level so that the players that have the options and that they're utilizing futures to bid their positions, and particularly the indices, up to certain levels, will just let those go and actually move out of them because they didn't have to hold them after the fact that they made their money on their options or they didn't lose their money on their options. So anyway, lots of happenings there. But I think the one thing that you have to remember is, well, two things. Number one, you don't want to fight the Fed. You don't want to fight the governments. And that's just a loser's game. The fact is, they're the house. They have unlimited amounts of money. So whatever you and I may think about what's going on around the world, the slowing economics and all that, okay, that's important. But you have to question two things. Number one, what do other people believe? And is it actually going to be getting worse? Or is it stabilizing at this point and will get better? And maybe that's because of stimulus or some other kind of monetary policy, fiscal policy around the world. And secondly, I think that the main thing is that you have to look at the price action. Now, I always say that if there's 100 people in a room and everybody's wrong and you're the only one that's right and you really believe that, the fact of the matter is you're wrong. So what we did here, I'll tell you, for example, we pretty much hedged out our portfolio over the last week or so to have somewhat of a neutral bias. We had some options in there. We had some shorts in there. We had about 55% individual equities that were still in our portfolio that really acted extremely well over the last number of days and the last few weeks. But at the same time, we felt it was really prudent to hedge out the risk of what was going to happen not only over the weekend, but what's going to happen post that, because you still have a lot of the issues in Spain. You have the domestic markets here, and we have a big meeting that's happening in Mexico this week as well, that they're looking for additional money to the IMF to aid in the global slowdown or the recovery of that. So you have China slowing down, all that. You have all these things happening. We know that. there's some areas that are actually good. So, you know, you have some things that are counterbalancing as well as counterintuitive in these markets right now. So don't beat yourself up too much. It's okay. Fact is, if you look at the price and you look at the action and you play along with that, oftentimes from a technical basis, it's a lot better off. But paying attention to the fundamentals right now is also important. But don't let the headlines totally spook you out, because there is a lot of other behind-the-scenes things that we don't really often know about that are occurring that could pop at any given time. Realize also that even though it seemed really bizarre that the euro moved up last week into the weekend in particular, there was a few things that happened. Let me give you a couple of ideas. First, the Swiss were buying and outwardly and openly buying the euro to protect their currency. They have a certain currency peg that they said is going to be, you know, in line, in play, and they don't really care how much it costs them to back that up. So that's something that's interesting. The second thing is that into last week, there was the greatest level of short interest on the euro that has ever been in history. And what does that mean? That means that any kind of move to the contrary, any kind of buying that's coming in, would really whipsaw those short players, and they'll be covering. Well, governments know this, and individuals know this, hedge funds know this. So what's going to happen? Well, in protecting the euro, it's a great time to actually go after it. And again, you're fighting the house on this one in a way when you have the currency trade that they want to make sure that it looks like the currency is strong, that the European region is strong. And the way they do that, they believe, is to increase the value of their currency. So you're fighting a lot of different cross currents right there. And so while it may look like the euro is actually stronger, even in the face of a Spanish banking disaster and Greece and everything that's going on right now, the fact is that, you know, you have other things that are playing into this. On top of that, you have the idea that stimulus may be coming by the Fed, in whatever form it may be, and that drops the dollar down, and that's a big part of the whole world's economy. So commodities got a bid last week. Did you see what happened with natural gas? Natural gas inventories came out on Thursday, and they were tight. Natural gas was up like 14% that one day. I mean, wow. Again, very, very solid levels of short interest on the natural gas. And in fact, one of the things that I want to tell you here with this is that oftentimes you want to look for short interest, really high levels of short interest. Most of the time, investors think that short interest is saying that a lot of the smart money is betting against it, and therefore it will continue down, or it should be something that should be sold. But for traders, they look at it as, hey, if there's any kind of good news coming out, that's going to pop. That's what happened with the euro, and that's what happened with natural gas last week, and that's what happens with individual stocks. When you see that you're breaking over key resistance levels and there's a high level of short interest, that could be a signal to actually get into something on an individual stock basis. Think about that. In fact, the opposite is true also. When there's not a lot of short interest and things start moving down, the short interest will pile in, and that will drive things even lower. So consider that as a contrary indicator sometimes of what you may be wanting to look for as a stock. We always look at short interest. I think it's a very important indicator, one of the things that you really want to look at for breakouts and opportunities for short squeeze, because short squeeze situations can be very violent, very quick, very profitable. So confidence was down last week. We saw that the University of Michigan confidence index was at 74, I believe it was. It was the lowest it's been in 5 or 6 months. That's kind of interesting. And that also is showing us that the global situation, whether it's the headlines or the actual joblessness in the world and the European slowdown, is really starting to affect consumers. So just keep aware of that and watch the consumer stocks, because while there may be a turnaround over time, but the fact of the matter is that consumers make up a great majority of our economy, and that means that consumers need to be happy. We've got to keep them happy. But with the fiscal cliff happening and the infighting that's going to probably be all the bashing in the political arenas and all of this bad news that's coming on, it's got to sour investors. I mean, it sours me. You know, who wants to listen to this anymore and deal with this? Kind of let's move on and find out what the real valuation is and go back to where it was, where we didn't have all this news flow that was every 5 minutes shifting things around back and forth. Kind of frustrating. I know if I'm frustrated, you're frustrated. But there is a global slowdown going on. We know that. Okay. Gold looks interesting. Gold looks like it has an opportunity here to start moving higher. We like the gold stocks. Not all of them, but a few of them. And they've been doing very, very well. I mean, look at Randgold Resources, G-O-L-D, recently. I mentioned that a few weeks back. boy, oh boy, that's been really cranking. Newmont Mining looks interesting. Anglo looks interesting as well, AEM. And there's a variety of other ones, some of the smaller ones. But these are solid companies, I think. And these are ones that we've been looking at and investing in on and off. And we have some positions in there now. The gold stocks will move up much greater than gold if gold does do well. So that's something to be looking for. But at the same time, I'm really cold on coal. Now, maybe coal is reaching a bottom, and maybe some of this movement of the dollar and maybe some of the resolution of what's happening around the world may help. But Cliffs came out with a bad report after the close on Friday and said that they're going to slow down production and, you know, they're going to try to slow things down there. That could be good because then you start to raise the price of coal possibly because they shorten up their production. At the same time, it's not so good because the realization is that they just, you know, it's costing too much for them to actually mine and there's possibly not as much of a demand. Kind of goes in hand with the discussion of natural gas, right? A lot more natural gas is being used because it was so cheap, and that's starting a little bit of a chain reaction in other energy markets. But right now, one of the things I want to really focus in is, you know, there's a question, why are the markets moving so fast? Well, over the last several months, we've seen that markets have been moving down quickly and up quickly, and what happens is when you get these kind of mini gaps, these zones, these fast zones, there's very little volume at a lot of the levels. There's no real support or resistance. So once you get the markets to move up above a level or into a level of no resistance area, no volume, you see quick spikes and quick drops. Until that fills up with volume and creates somewhere in that zone a level that is, I guess, considered market that is generally considered in fair value, you know, that is considered in equilibrium. And that's an important thing to think about. Markets in equilibrium. Where is it that the buyers and the sellers are kind of thinking, hey, this is the right price? Those are the lines that will hold for a while. Those are usually your support and resistance points when you look at some more advanced metrics of support and resistance. And I think that right now there is no equilibrium because right now there is this level of movement that there's a lot of pushing and pulling and tugging of war going on. Tug of war going on with regards to the news and the sentiment and what the outlook is and what it's going to be. So you're moving very quickly because we're right on the edge of these levels. We're getting right up to the top and then dropping down, then getting to the bottom and drop and then moving up, and we're out of equilibrium. When things move a lot slower inside of an area that you have maybe bouncing along a support point or hitting above and moving into a resistance point, and it's kind of holding, and that's a nice equilibrium point, and that's where it makes it that it's a much better area for price discovery because things are moving around, quote-unquote, normally. So anyway, I thought those are a couple things to think about. By the way, happy Father's Day to everybody out there who is celebrating or is a father, grandfather, father-to-be. I had a very nice day. We had some time with my family and some barbecue down here in Florida. It's a beautiful day here. I want to mention GoToMeeting real quickly. GoToMeeting, you know, they have a iPad giveaway contest, and they have all sorts of great things that are going on, but I just want to tell you how great this is. We did hold a GoToWebinar, actually, last week for TriggerPoint Research, and we had pretty much a packed capacity. Thank you for joining us. We learned about different key indicators and how to find breakouts and breakdown zones. We have three more coming up, so make sure you register for those over at Trigger Point Research. And I've told you that before, how to get there. Go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Is a on this podcast show notes. There's actually a place to register or to click to get there. But it was so great to use them because we were able to bring on not only the PowerPoint presentation that was moving and the actual live charts that we were using, and then share my browser, and everybody was able to participate, ask questions. We had polls, we had surveys. Very cool system to work with. And you know what? You can try GoToMeeting with HD Faces for free for 30 days. All you have to do is go to meeting.com, and you can try it free. It's right there on the front there. Use the promo code podcast, download the free app, and there you go. You're off and running, and you can be sharing meetings and doing some great things as well there. The other thing I'll mention to you is we still have the 14-day free trial that's ongoing over at Trigger Point Research. And, man, we hit a couple of home runs recently, both on the short and the long side. Check it out, because what you'll do is you'll get the instant text or email messages on the stock that's breaking out. There's not a lot of them that happen all day, so you don't have to worry about being bombarded. Sometimes there's none. Sometimes it's two or three. We give you updates of when the stop price is getting close and maybe take some profits or on a resistance point or when the target's reached. Or, you know, we give you a very easy-to-follow program at Trigger Point Research so that you can actually find an alert that is looking to break out. We give you the rationale behind it. We give you charts, and we give you the whole kind of a neat package and a bundle right there so you can make the decision of what to do moving forward. And, you know, it kind of gives you a nice guide on what to do. And, again, we've done it recently. We put out some recommendations on gold and on we had actually LNG Cheniere, which is up about 22% in about a week and a half. We had some nice shorts recently that were Polaris down about, we made about 10% after it dropped down. That expired. We have a 30-day maximum on there. Check out TriggerPointResearch.com and get your free 14-day, absolutely free, pro package. You can try it out and check it out and see if you like it. And I recommend it very, very highly because a lot of the work that we do with our portfolios is the work we do with those kind of indicators. Let's get to our guest. And all the way from England, the UK, we have Jennifer McCune. She's with Capital Economics. She's a senior economic advisor there, or an economic researcher there. And we want to talk a lot about what's happening with some areas that she covers in particular that we've really been focusing on. Last week, we talked about how Das wrote an article about Germany and how Germany is really in a squeeze right now, and I want to get her opinion. So how are you, Jennifer?
I'm well, thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us. All right, so you're obviously very busy in your research. It's not a dull time for you at all, right?
No, absolutely. There's a lot going on. It's the most interesting time since I've worked as an economist, certainly.
And you used to be with the Bank of England.
That's right, yes, 6 or 7 years ago now.
So you know both sides. You know kind of the inside the governmental space, if you will, right, in terms of really looking at things from that aspect, I suppose, you know, more of that. And then you also know it from the private sector.
That's right, yes, although obviously my time on the inside, as it were, was in the UK rather than in the Eurozone, which is what I specialize on now.
Yeah, you call it the inside. It sounds like a prison.
Sorry?
I'm on the inside. That sounds like a prison.
No, not quite that bad.
So let's talk a little bit about some things that are going on. And we all know that in Europe, and this is obviously the point we've been talking about a lot, but in Europe, we see that the contraction is accelerating. We saw that the Flash Index recently dropped to about 45.9 for the manufacturing, lowest in almost 3 years. And obviously, a reading below 50 is considered contraction. And some places are better than others, but is this kind of, in your view, accelerating to a point? Is it leveling off? What's happening here?
Yes, I'm afraid it does seem to be accelerating. As you said, some areas are much worse than others. And for a very long time now, the southern and peripheral economies have been in recession or close to it. That situation seems to be getting worse. But also what we've seen more recently is even the likes of Germany have seen their economies deteriorating. And those PMI surveys that you mentioned are below the no change level of 50 pretty much across the board now.
So the latest reading from Germany was that their manufacturing finally is starting to slow up. And a lot of people thought that Germany was immune to a lot of the problems because they would have, you know, they're an exporting economy, manufacturing economy, and they, you know, do a great job out of it, obviously, very efficient country. And, you know, they were doing a lot of work with their cars, for example, and selling them to Asia, et cetera. One of the things I found really interesting lately was that there was a lot of talk about how great car sales have been to Asia, particularly China. But the other side of the coin was that China's seeing incredible inventory build, and they are having to do a lot of discounting and promotions to sell their cars, and they're kind of like, hey, stop sending us all these cars.
Right, okay. Well, I'm sure it's certainly true to an extent that Germany is benefiting from demand in Asia, much more so than other economies in the Eurozone, which export much more just within the region. But even for Germany, exports to within the Eurozone account for about half of its total exports. Those to Asia are much less important, I think under 10%. While Germany can benefit to some extent to its exposure to Asia, that's just not the most important point for Germany at all. What really matters to Germany is demand elsewhere in Europe, and in particular elsewhere in the Eurozone. And that's obviously weakening dramatically.
So what happens now where Germany, in their quest to make sure that they don't have to foot the bill for all of the wrongdoings or the problems, whatever you want to call it, of the other peripheral countries, what happens and how does this work that they mandate or a big part of the mandate to have austerity measures, where obviously that means lower spending, cost cutting, you know, really ripping it down hard. How does that fit with their idea that they can actually grow their economy with that?
Well, I think Germany is considers austerity to be a necessary precondition for growth. I think it's prepared to accept a period of economic weakness in order to create what it believes is a sustainable economy. It thinks that if all the other peripheral economies can reduce their debts, regain market trust, then in the longer run, the economies can start to grow again. Unfortunately, I think that's rather too optimistic. At the moment, the fact is that this austerity in these economies is just making a very, very bad situation even worse. And what's more, Germany really isn't prepared to pull up its own demand to do more to increase domestic spending in Germany, which would in turn benefit the other peripheral economies by at least providing an external source of demand for them. So I think it's bad in both ways.
It seems that the battle between the countries that have difficulty with their finances and really just now Germany, ever since Hollande took over, of course, who is now more of a spender, he wants to spend and grow the economy, versus Sarkozy, who is obviously, you know, more in line with Merkel. But it looks like it's kind of them against Germany these days. Is that seemingly from your side of the pond how it is?
You're right that France has shifted its stance fairly markedly lately. However, there are other economies that are more on Germany's side of things. For example, the likes of Finland, the Netherlands, are very concerned about ploughing more and more money into the peripheral economies, allowing them to increase their debts even further. They are quieter than Germany. Less attention is paid to those economies because they are smaller. But I don't think Germany is alone, although it is becoming increasingly isolated in this.
Finland seems to be the thorn in the side here. I mean, they're really pissed off. It seems like they're really kind of very much like, hey, wait a minute. We want to stick to the rules because the rules were set for a certain reason. For example, changing anything or votes for the ESM distributions are 100. I believe they're 100% of all the participating countries required, right?
Yes, depending on which rules need to be changed, yes.
Right. And, you know, at the same time, recently the Spanish quote-unquote bailout, which was, you know, supposed to, the first news was, okay, it's going to be money through the ESM, which hasn't been ratified yet, and we know that it needs a 100% vote to do so.
Yes.
And at the same time, then it shifted, this is at least how I saw it, to the EFSF. Okay, they'll do that. Then they'll go through the FRAB, which is, you know, we're in acronym hell these days, in my opinion. But, you know, it's crazy.
That's absolutely right. Things are becoming very, very confusing. In a way, I think perhaps that benefits the authorities in that the average person doesn't quite understand what's going on, isn't quite aware of whether they're committing more of taxpayers' money or not. I think really the problem at the moment is whether this money is going to come from a new source, or whether it's just going to be using up existing funds. And Germany's very much on the side at the moment of using up funds that have already been committed in the past. They're not providing any extra money. And also, it wants the new loans that are going to Spain to have a preferred creditor status, meaning that the other Eurozone countries would be repaid these loans before anybody else was, in the event that Spain struggled to repay its debts.
Right, which means that, for example, they'll be paid first. So the problem is now they subordinated others who, that in itself sounds like a great idea because they're protecting themselves. At the same time, it's like, wait a minute, why in the world would I buy these bonds if now all of a sudden I have somebody on top of me that's going to be a higher, more preferred payout? I mean, doesn't that just dry up the private capital?
Yes, it does. It's a real problem. I think that the more that loans are subordinated, the more that Spain will struggle to attract the private capital that it needs, that it will struggle to raise finance, and more it will need bailouts. So I think really it would be better if the loans were provided by the EFSF, which would mean that they didn't have any special status, that they were treated in the same way as other bondholders.
But either way, it's going to have to go to Spain and be on Spain's balance sheet or on the liability side, and that's going to create even more of debt to GDP, which then obviously even creates more of a problem because they can't pay that back as it is.
Yes, that's right. This loan, if they get the full $100 billion, it will increase the debt to GDP ratio by something like 10%. Spain's government debt is actually relatively low compared to a lot of the other peripheral economies. But the more that those debts are built up by banking bailouts, of course, the worse it starts to look. And the more there is a risk that the government itself needs to default at some point or needs to get a bailout. Because at the moment, of course, the bailout is purely going to the government for the banking sector. It's not meant to be for the government itself. But the government's unlikely to be able to carry on with these debts for very long, particularly if the economy continues to weaken as it has lately. So it may well be that it needs a bailout for its own purposes, not just for its banks.
Yeah, which then creates more bailout, which it's just a perpetual cycle of just ugliness. What was the thinking behind with the Spanish bailout? First of all, here's my opinion. They did it on a Saturday. They should have done it on a Sunday. Only because you need that shock and awe to squeeze the shorts out of stuff. And, you know, it gave people time to think and to look at it. For example, one of the things that was involved was there was no conditions attached to it, which was very odd because part of the mandate for the ESFF and the ESM and the money distributed is that it has to go to sovereigns only. So then you create some kind of funnel to make it look okay. And then what happens is you have to have some kind of economic plan behind it. Now, every other bailout that was done, Greece, Portugal, Italy, there was severe economic requirements and austerity. Now, what was the thinking behind giving these guys no conditions?
Well, I think we don't really know what conditions are involved at the moment is one of the problems. They have been relatively vague. I don't think the details have been fully decided upon. It certainly seems to be the case that they won't have the same kinds of conditions in terms of austerity. They won't be required to reduce their borrowing to X or Y in the way that Greece and Portugal have been. But it does look as if there will be some conditions on the banking sector. But that's one of the problems here is that there's still a lot of uncertainty around it. So it's not had the same impact on market sentiment that it could have had if it was made very clear exactly how the loan will be provided and exactly what the conditions would be on it. I think one of the reasons for announcing it over a weekend was to try and avoid a jolt market reaction, which would later be reversed, and the kind of instability that we've seen around the loss of the bailouts. But that hasn't happened because when it was announced, people really weren't clear on what it meant. Initially, there was a lot of optimism about it. Then markets went away, considered what it really meant, and decided that after all, it wasn't such a good thing. So we've seen the same kind of market instability despite the fact that it was announced over a weekend.
So here's a question, and I don't know if you can exactly answer this, but seriously, do they have any idea what they're doing over there? It looks like they're just throwing crap against the wall and hoping something sticks. There's no thought, there's no details, there's never any details.
Well, I think what we have to understand is that it's extremely difficult to come to an agreement with so many countries involved. I think the situation does seem to be improving a bit. Previously, bailouts for Greece, for Portugal, have been decided at very much the 11th hour when there's been absolutely no choice but to do something. These things have been decided at 4 o'clock in the morning as a last-ditch attempt to pull things together. At least this time with Spain, it seems that something has been done a little bit in advance of the crisis point. And there's perhaps a bit more detail than we've seen in the past. But it unfortunately does seem very clear that policymakers are very much behind events and unable to respond quickly enough to this growing crisis.
How happy is everybody in your country that you did not join the euro currency?
Well, I think it would be fair to say that the people who were skeptical about the eurozone are certainly claiming that they were right to be at the time, and there is certainly some relief. There are far fewer people now claiming that we should have joined the eurozone or that we still should. I think from this country's perspective, the problem is that we're calling very loudly for something to be done to improve the situation, for much more money to be put into it, for policymakers to be far more preemptive. But we've done very little in terms of actually putting up money ourselves, and we are, after all, members of the EU. And I think that really sort of it illustrates the point for the whole of Europe. While everybody can say that something should be done, a solution needs to be found, that that's probably going to involve a lot more money, there's a big question about just who is going to provide that money, and Germany alone, unsurprisingly, isn't willing to do so.
Yeah, right. Now, what about the overall ECB? There's a question of whether they have enough money to cover what's going on, and you know, the question then again is, who's going to? I guess it's back to the same question: who's going to put in money? I mean, already the IMF is kind of like on the outsides, and I guess we're going to wait on the U.S., which is a big part of the IMF, to do anything. You know, does the ECB have enough money for covering Spain? And what about Italy? Their yields are spiking as well now again.
Yes. Well, in theory, the ECB could print enough money. Mm-hmm. It's not supposed to. It's against various treaties. But in the past, the ECB has certainly bent the rules, has managed to find ways around buying government bonds, for example. So I think if it was really believed at the ECB that that was the right way forward, then rules would be changed or circumvented in order to allow that to happen. And then, in theory, the ECB has an unlimited capacity to print money. The only issue, really, that would hold it back once the laws had been altered would be the risk of inflation. And I think that really is a very, very distant risk, given the weakness of the Eurozone economies. Mm-hmm. But I think the big point from the ECB's perspective is that it just does not see this as its role. It doesn't believe that it should be supporting Eurozone governments. It's done a lot to provide liquidity to the banking sector. That hasn't spread equally throughout the Eurozone, but the ECB has claimed that it's not its responsibility to make sure that that happens. And meanwhile, it feels very, very strongly that it shouldn't be directly financing governments' borrowing.
Right. And then when it comes to, you know, for example, what happened in France recently, I believe they dropped the retirement age from 65 to 60 in spite of all that's happening. You know, how does that fit with the whole model of trying to firm up your finances and you know, scale back on retirement benefits and things of that nature?
Again, I think it just shows, well, most of the countries could see that austerity would be beneficial to some extent. It's extremely hard to pass individual measures. Now, what's happened in France is that François Hollande plans to reverse partially a reform that Sarkozy put through in order to increase the retirement age. And I really do see that as a step backward. That was something that was really a structural improvement for France, and it's a shame that that can't be put forward anymore. Also, Hollande plans to increase the number of teaching positions, and there are various measures that will hold back the speed of austerity and the speed of, perhaps more importantly, of structural reform for the medium term. But I think as and when elections come up, it's always going to be the case that that candidates campaign on a popular platform. They want to be voted in, after all. And those claiming that they're going to cut back on public spending, implement tax hikes, are just simply unlikely to be voted in. So while in normal times it might be possible to talk about structural reforms, to talk about austerity, at election time it becomes much harder to actually implement that.
Yeah. And in closing, the final question I have is looking back over the last several years, it looks like the one scenario the one country that really made things work, at least not to get themselves back in trouble as at this point too much, is Iceland, right? Didn't Iceland kind of get themselves out of trouble without all the, you know, repercussions of all this? I mean, they were very drastic, obviously.
Iceland is certainly beginning to pull its way out. But as an economy on its own, outside of a currency union or a monetary union, it's had a lot more flexibility to be able to do that. It's been able to intervene in its exchange rate. It's been able to implement capital controls. It's been able to default to it to a huge extent without the kind of straitjacket that those within the Eurozone face at the moment. Mm-hmm. And of course, it remains to be seen just how Iceland will perform looking ahead, whether markets will trust the Icelandic government, the Icelandic banks in future.
All right. And in closing, just a one question, simple, maybe yes or no. Is the Eurozone project, the whole thing, you know, the whole single currency, bringing this together, is this something that will work?
In its current form, no. I think we'll see at least, between 1 and 3 economies exiting in the next year.
Interesting. Well, Jennifer McEwen from Capital Economics, we'll put all the information on how to check out all your writings in the Capital Economics website. I do appreciate you joining us today.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Nice job, Jennifer. Thank you.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
I'll send you about the links on where that hits up, okay?
And
Hello? Yeah, I'll send you the links on where that hits up.
Okay, great.
And if you could save a little Marmite for me, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, right. Great.
See ya. Bye.
Goodbye.
Well, that was great. Very interesting. Good stuff from Capital Economics. I encourage you to go check out the things that they write about, talk about, research. It's a bit of on an institutional level, but some great stuff that they come out with. And you got to love that accent. I'm sorry, but we always say that. You know, they sound so smart over there in England. Their accent's just, I don't know what it is, different than... My Brooklyn boys kind of have the same discussion, same topic, same words out of their mouth. And somehow, I don't know, the English make it sound so, so intelligent. Anyway, we're going to wrap it up about here. A little bit of a shorter show because of Father's Day. And we're going to have to figure out what's going on moving forward. I will be posting a lot of things this week on The Disciplined Investor through Twitter, et cetera, on what's going on with the whole situation on the market changing its trend, as well as some ideas that you may want to be looking at, the economics that are coming up this week, leading indicators, etc., as well as the fact of the eventual final resolution to what's going to happen with Greece, which still may not be this week, but we'll find out soon enough what the actual results are, not only from the election, but the coalition parties that may come together, and then what that means for the rest of the euro. And then on top of that, of course, we'll have to see what happens with Spanish bonds this week that hit 7% last week, and some of the more exciting areas that are going to happen at the middle of the week with Bernanke giving some kind of indication of what his intentions are. So with that, I appreciate you joining us. We'll see you next week on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.